tout d'abord, je voudrais remercier les organisateurs de ce colloque, de m'avoir invité à participer. Je suis très admirative de cette initiative d'inviter les collègues qui ont absolument ou très peu d'expertise dans le domaine du jouet. Donc, il faut souligner tout de suite, de façon maghrébine, que je ne suis pas ni conservatrice, ni historienne, ni restauratrice de jouets, et que ceci n'est pas une poupée. Voilà pour mon intervention en français. La suite sera en anglais pour ne pas trop vous faire souffrir, au moins en ce qui concerne la langue, mais je serai très heureuse de répondre comme je peux dans les deux langues à des questions à la fin. I don't think I need to clarify my opening statement in English. The image speaks for itself. Other than to re-emphasize that I, alas, have none of the shared expertise of most of the speakers in this conference in the domain of history, fabrication, conservation, and anthropological significance of toys, and in particular of dolls. My own research has been directed towards the fabrication and function of the mannequin, also called a lay figure in English, sometimes too referred to as the artist's poupée, or doll, and this in anticipation of an exhibition we plan at the museum in 2014. I'll argue that the changes and refinements that took place in its fabrication, notably from the last decades of the 18th century, are crucial to understanding the artist's changing, or rather expanding, use of the mannequin, how it came to affect what we might call the relationship between the artist and his implement. I'm not going to attempt to address this latter question in any great detail today, we won't have time, but I'll show a few examples at the end of my talk to suggest that if the mannequin was not a toy, si ceci en effet n'était pas un jouet, it nevertheless came to be used by painters and photographers to playful ends, and in some cases arguably became the artist's plaything or playmate. So, what do we understand by a mannequin, and what was its role in artistic practice? This is where giving the talk in English presents certain problems, for I need to explain that I'll be using the term mannequin rather than lay figure throughout the lecture. Both are used in English, but the more open-ended definition of mannequin is better suited to the ambitions of the wider exhibition project, summarized by what you see on the screen. Etymology cannot be our main concern today, however, as it adds little to our consideration of function and fabrication. Suffice it to say that with some qualifications, it's generally accepted that the word mannequin derives from the Dutch mannequin or mannequin, please forgive the pronunciation. Just think of the urinating mannequin piece in Brussels. It appears to become specifically associated with artistic practice from at least the beginning of the 17th century. As Aurélie Gaillard has suggested in her book on Diderot and painting, it's recorded with this definition in dictionaries published from the end of the 17th century. And of course, Diderot describes it in this way in his Encyclopédie and also illustrates it in a number of plates. It seems certain that some form of substitute human figure was used in medieval workshops. However, the first more detailed records of how they were made and what they were used for dates from the 15th century. Avelino Filaretti, in his Treatise of Architecture of 1451 to 65, writes of figuretti di legname and gives instructions about how the artist should use them, clothing them in, I quote, a little dress of linen in whatever fashion you choose, as if it were alive. Another key source, of course, is Vasari, who in his 1550 edition of The Lives of the Artists notes that Fra Bartolomeo, in particular, was one of the first artists to make extensive use of the mannequin, though often wrongly credited with inventing it. Fra Bartolomeo had two types, a little wooden figure of the type described by Filaretti, and a large wooden figure also made of wood, and grande quant'il vivo, used, as Vasari wrote, to draw folds of drapery and other similar things. Looking first at the small figures, the progenitors of the figure on the table here, straight from BHV, documentary evidence suggests that they were very widespread in use from at least the late 16th century onwards, including by such artists as Correggio, Barocci, Veronese, Tintoretto, and even Titian, who was said by Lomazzo to prefer woolen to wooden ones. The sources tell us that they were about 20 to 23 to 50 or 55 centimetres high, generally made of wood or wax, and the wax usually mixed with additives such as turpentine, linseed, oil, fat, soot, and occasionally red ochre. It could be that the wooden types look not dissimilar to the little wooden figures on the screen, known by the German term Gliederpuppen, with their fine carving and gender-specific details. However, it's precisely this high degree of finish, and in some cases, the ability to manipulate them marionette-like by using catgut string through holes in the head, that's led to their use by artists to be questioned, as it seems at least as likely that there were sorts of precious curiosities to be collected for display in Kunstkammer. On the whole, the literature suggests that wax was recommended over wood, as it made the figures more malleable and easier to manipulate into appropriate positions. Also because, as a softer base, it created more fluid folds in the material it supported. In the studio, painters put into various uses with the overall aim of achieving stylistic and compositional coherence. And this, again, makes me think of an element of the toy which Gilles Brugère pointed out this morning, un outil pour apprendre. On a very basic level, they help to establish a broad understanding of anatomical proportion, the scale of the head, the length of the arms, the size of the feet, and so on. Importantly, too, they register the disposition of light and shade, and so allow the painter to ensure overall compositional harmony, what Dufresnoy, in his L'Art de Peinture, called voir les masses et grandes lumières et des grandes ombres et l'effet de tout ensemble. Dufresnoy also records that in combination with life-size mannequins, they were especially useful for rendering special effects such as reflections. By posing them on planks of wood, I suppose we could recreate it here vaguely with the water, planks of wood at the appropriate height near a metal tub filled with water. But above all, they were key instruments in fixing perspective and understanding the human figure in unusual foreshortening. Numerous authors go to considerable length to explain how mannequins should be disposed on a flat surface and the precise angle and height at which the latter should be set. In some cases, this plane formed the floor of a box-like construction with holes cut in the side as windows so that the artist could look through the sides and observe the figures from different angles, as well as recording the fall of light. One famous example was the Venetian artist Tintoretto, who used what Ridolfi calls piccoli modelli in wax or chalk. This goes back to something that Helmut Schwarz said this morning, disposed in a box, and we sense very much this box-like enclosure in this painting, or suspended from a string attached to a wire grid to get the right foreshortening for his ceiling paintings. By far the best-known example, without doubt, is Poussin. This is his picture of Rebecca and Eliezer at the Louvre, whose several biographers confirm his practice of using une boîte cube, more or less as Tintoretto did, as well as figures draped with paper or taffeta, as we would have been common by that date, but also to secure perspectives, Poussin used a system of drawn strings so that his figures were correctly positioned vis-à-vis the horizon. Generally speaking, the materials used in the fabrication of these small figurines remain more or less consistent for centuries afterwards, as can be seen by those made by late 19th century artists, such as Gustave Moreau, for his own compositions, recently studied in an excellent exhibition, L'Homme aux Figures de Cire, at the Musée Moreau. Even if Moreau, of course, was able to take advantage of commercially available armatures readily available from artist suppliers at the end of the 19th century. However, in the case of life-size mannequins, the changes in their fabrication were much more extensive and ambitious, and it's on these that I'd like to concentrate today. I've yet to find a detailed description of large-scale mannequin fabricated in Renaissance Italy, and the very rare surviving images, such as this drawing by Salviati, focused on the lay figure, obviously, don't give us much helpful detail other than establishing that they were indeed life-size. It's not perhaps too far-fetched to suggest that they were early progenitors of the large Pandora or Poupée de la Rue Saint-Honoré that were used in fashion dolls in the 18th century. These are known to have been about 1.60 meters high and made out of papier-mâché or moulded cardboard, as some prefer, over an internal chassis of wood. And the image also suggests that there was a degree of articulation in the principal joints. Like the figurines, these full-size mannequins were also important for registering the distribution of light and shade, though unlike their smaller cousins, at least until the 19th century, their dimensions and necessary support mechanisms, by which I mean the stand, which is holding the doll straight, prevented them from being used in multi-figure compositions. Some authors make their role as interpreter in a pictorial drama very clear. Gérard de Lairès, in his Grand Livre de Peintre, for example, suggests that the artist should assume the pose himself in a way which suggested the emotions he wanted to convey, then make a brief sketch, then afterwards adjust the mannequin to recreate the pose in a way that was a sort of transformation of a tableau vivant into a nature morte. But by far the most important role for the mannequin, as all authors agreed and I've already alluded, was as a support or display mechanism for drapery. And here, of course, there's a clear link with the fashion dolls we heard a little bit about this morning. But by far the most important role for the mannequin, the mannequin assured that a living model, which could include distinguished patrons for portrait sittings, I'll come back to that, did not have to endure long hours of uncomfortable posing with or without the sort of artificial aid you see in this photograph by Lindley Sanborn of the 1890s. Although artists and art theoreticians all prioritised drawing directly from the nude, all accepted, more or less reluctantly, the inevitability of using a mannequin as a substitute figure for the specific purpose of drapery. Far from being an accessory, drapery was considered a key expressive element in a composition that also showed the degree to which the artist mastered the painting of the human figure itself. This is emphasized again and again in texts by Sandra, Roger de Pile, Dufresnoy, Mengs, and numerous others. And indeed some, like de Lairès, considered that the only way to achieve natural-looking drapery was to use a mannequin. And this is obviously de Lairès clutching his mannequin in this painting by Wilhelm von Kaulbach. In almost all cases, however, these authors recommended that the mannequin should be used with caution. While it could help the painter in the various ways I've outlined, it could also skew the naturalism that the painter sought to achieve by taking too great advantage of the mannequin's immobility to render a very stilted and imbalanced composition. So with all this doubt, who did use them? They were, after all, generally rather expensive items. The answer is pretty much any artist who could afford one. Finding detailed evidence of artists' use can prove problematic. As studio tools, they were no more commented upon in biographies and journals than, say, brushes or easels. And regular use has ensured that the evidence, that is, the mannequins themselves, have largely been destroyed, and this brings me back to the introduction this morning and the comment that la poupée n'était pas prévue pour durer, le jouet, I'm sorry. In addition to the art historical sources I've quoted, we can deduce their use from catalogues of posthumous studio sales. Those are the painters such as Charles-Antoine Coypel in 1752 and Giraudet in 1825, are two examples. They had eight mannequins between them. And in a few rare cases, information can be gleaned from obituaries, such as that of the 18th century engraver Gravelot, who we are told by his obituarist had them made in London. Gravelot is an example of the role of the mannequin in the private atelier, but in academies too, their use was silently condoned. Silently, because it did not feature in any course of study, and because the use, or perhaps better, the overuse of a mechanical device of this sort was thought to be inconsistent with being a painter of genius. But again, archival research shows that they were in constant use within the academies, at least from the 18th century, and almost certainly the 17th century in the case of the French Academy. At the Royal Academy in London, council minutes of 1769, the year after the Academy was funded, record bills for the payment of the huge sum of £100 to a Mr. Edison of Covent Garden. By the middle of the following century, the president was being asked by students to give them a female as well as a male mannequin, and this a request that he declined on the grounds that they could adapt the one they had. 30 years later, in the 1870s, students and professors sent an appeal to the then-president, Lord Leighton, to have the mannequin repaired. Leighton, who used mannequins extensively in his own work and certainly for this painting of Flaming June, would doubtless have been more sympathetic. The situation was no different at the Académie des Beaux-Arts in Paris. Archives at the École des Beaux-Arts show that the mécanicien Guillois was presenting his wares to the scrutiny of such painters as Vien, Pajou, and the sculptor Houdon in March 1799. The assembled academicians pronounced themselves très satisfaits with the mechanism of what they call the squelette, which is what you see in the screen, but asked to be reassured that it would lose none of its freedom of movement once fitted with its garniture, that is, padding and very possibly a head, and I'll come back to that a little later in the talk. You'll note that I've made the first mention of a maker by name, Guillois, and from the end of the 18th century, it becomes increasingly possible to identify mannequin makers and to track the improvements and developments that they made. As such, Guillois marks an important turning point in a profession which was to flourish throughout the following century. What we see, and especially in Paris, is the development of a profession in which manufacturers and suppliers vigorously competed with one another to introduce ever more sophisticated products that responded to the demands of their artist clients. Britain never assumed the same importance in the domain of the fabrication of artist mannequins as France, but the overall tendency towards an increasingly specialized trade was the same. The trend was to combine mannequin making with other trades, originally at least. Mr. Edison, whom I mentioned, supplied the Royal Academy, evidently went into mannequin making as a lucrative sideline to his wider woodwork business, which included making prosthetic limbs, most famously for the potter Josiah Wedgwood. The same is true of Simon Hennequin, one of whose small mannequin survives at Los Angeles County Museum of Art, who was active in London from the 1740s to the 1770s, and perhaps more predictably doubled up as a carver, gilder, and frame maker. One of the most useful records of mannequin making in Britain is the excellent source devoted to artist suppliers developed by Jacob Simon and others at the National Portrait Gallery in London. What's clear from it and other archival sources, though, is that many of those who supplied mannequins in Britain turned to France to source their figures. One, Robert Briggs, imported them in 1848, imported them from the French branch of his own business, which continued to produce those he himself made during a 12-year residence in Paris, suggesting that he probably learned his trade here. Similarly, one of the leading artist suppliers of the 19th century in Europe, Charles Robison, whose archive is in the Conservation Institute attached to the Fitzwilliam Museum, proudly advertised Parisian stuffed lay figures, probably those referred to in French catalogues as mannequins perfectionnés, as his top-of-the-range deluxe models. Robison is known to have bought these directly from Parisian suppliers for over 40 years. First from 1842 from Auguste Gagnéry, I'll come back to him, then over subsequent decades from Briggs, whom I've just mentioned, Le Chartier Barbe, a firm of French origin but trading in London, and for over three decades from 1851 from Pité Lenné. Clearly, then, French mannequins were widely recognized as a class apart, and in the 19th century, French mannequin makers went to some extraordinary lengths to ensure that they maintained their reputation. It's true, too, that French manufacturers more actively promoted this specialist trade in associated literature, and indeed produced one of the earliest known histories of mannequin manufacture and use, Barrier's short book, Sur le mannequin, discours dans lequel on traite de son invention, de sa perfection et de son usage, which was published in 1809. Clearly written to promote Guiwa, who must have been a friend, and who'd had his mannequin accepted by the Académie des Beaux-Arts, it nevertheless gives a useful resume of the state of mannequin making in Paris at that point and lists some of the most significant manufacturers. Barrier's principal aim, however, was to record the evolution of what he calls the naturalistic mannequin and to show the extraordinary progress that had been and was continuing to be made to this end. Until the end of the 18th century, Barrier claimed mannequins, such as the one made in iron, which I showed you reproduced by Diderot, had been too heavy and cumbersome. Earlier makers had been content to create very crude approximations of the human form, he wrote, which never display drapery to best advantage. The armature or squelette of those made by the sculptor Perrault, who was one of the most reputed mannequin makers in Paris in the mid-18th century, he considered it to be, in particular, to be infiniment vicieuse. More surprising was his criticism of the highly refined mannequins of Paul Huot, a maker highly sought after throughout Europe in the first years of the century, including by the English artist William Etty, ironically best known as one of the leading painters of the nude of his generation. We're fortunate to have an extremely well-preserved example of a Huot mannequin ordered at the cost of 100 francs in around 1830 by the now little-known Jean painter Auguste van der Emde from Kassel, where it still survives. For Barrier, to be naturalistic, a mannequin had to have purity of form, les formes pures, which demanded a special attention to the internal mechanism or squelette. Guiwa achieved this to an exceptional degree, Barrier believed, notably by making internal armature that more accurately imitated the human form, including such anatomical detail as the radius and ulna on the arm, and one which had far more flexibility of movement in the fingers, toes, and torso. Barrier's text and Guiwa's example set the tone for the development of the naturalistic mannequin over much of the rest of the century. Subsequent manufacturers repeatedly stressed the importance of perfecting the internal armature, using new technologies and new media to help them make the artificial body ever more fluid in its movements. The painter Faure, for example, advertised a mannequin perfectionné with molded elastic that improved the suppleness of the figure. The sophistication of many of the joints, and particularly the freely moving hips, turned it into what he called tout à fait le squelette humain rendu mécanique. His product clearly impressed, as he went on to win a bronze medal at the Exposition de l'Industrie in 1844 under the fine arts section. Now, this mannequin on the screen is not necessarily one by Faure, but it gives you some degree of an idea of the anatomical accuracy that Faure and others sought to achieve. 5 years later, in 1849, Auguste Gagneret, who referred to himself as a specialist fabricant de mannequins, so no other trade, and who I mentioned supplied Robeson in England, applied for a patent, a brevet, for a device which made it possible for the mannequin to stand unaided on its legs, comme dans la nature, and so to get rid of the supporting stand which was generally placed between the legs and which had previously prevented the smooth and harmonious fall of fabric. Complementing the efforts devoted to the mechanism and movements of the mannequin was a concern to create a naturalistic finish or garniture. Faure, for example, tried to achieve what Barrier called purity of form by stuffing with horsehair, crin, and cotton padding to create what he called exterior forms, which presumably meant breasts, buttocks, and in the case of this mannequin from a National Trust property in England, you can just see it, also nipples. In the case of female mannequins, extra realism was often achieved by covering with silk to give its exterior forms appropriate softness. Both Packwood House mannequin and the Huot models, which I've shown, show that the heads were painted naturalistically and in considerable detail, with the facility of having a wig attached for even greater realism. For the most part, they were made out of papier-mâché, setting the tone for the mannequin de vitrine or shop window dummies that continued the constant push towards ever greater naturalism and to some degree even hyper-realism, just as the artist's mannequin left off at the end of the 19th century. Given the main subject of this conference, it seems important to mention the considerable overlaps between advances in doll making and those in the manufacture of the artist mannequin, especially throughout the 19th century. Doll manufacturers were engaged in a similar effort to make their products more naturalistic, and as François Temer has pointed out, more often than not took their cues from artist mannequin, especially when it came to the articulation of the figure. There's time to mention only one striking example of this copycatism today, and that's of the doll maker Jean-Louis Hubert Arnault, whom Temer records in his Panorama des Poupées Parisiennes, registered a patent for a doll with rubber articulations in 1852 and 1854. In this case, it's hard to imagine that even if his design was considerably more simplified, he did not draw inspiration from a widely publicized new artist mannequin, also making extensive use of vulcanized rubber, brought out by Jean-Désiré Leblanc some years earlier in 1848, and granted a patent the following year when it was also presented to the Académie. Leblanc's particular concern was to improve flexibility, again, especially in the hips, which seems to be a particular challenge, but also what he called its airbound movements to make sure, for example, that the heel could touch the buttock and the mouth, the knee, so you get something incredibly complex like this design, which is some cross between a yogi and a robocop. But the inspiration could work in the opposite sense too. That is, the doll or mannequin makers responded to technological developments in other domains or sectors. It seems likely, for example, that Louis Allais and his partner, the picture dealer Léopold Sheridan, were influenced, at least in material and commercial terms, in their 1837 application for a brevet, by which you see on the screen. It's a brevet for a mannequin modelé en carton papier à l'usage des peintres. That were influenced by Dr. Louis Ozou's mass-marketed anatomical models produced from the late 1820s with the express intention of making a model more affordable than the wax versions that had been commonly available up to that point. Indeed, Allais, who described himself as a fabricant de sculptures en carton, expressly asserted in his application that his aim had been to make them both physically lighter and lighter on the artist's purse. Mannequin had come down considerably in price over the years, he wrote, but at between 800 and 900 francs in his own day were still too expensive. C'est trop, he wrote, and instead he offered his mannequin en carton for 200 francs, which is about a quarter of the price. Throughout this time of constant technological development, the basic function or functions of the mannequin, as described earlier, remained relatively consistent. What was key, however, was that their use was kept hidden, disguised, so that the finished painting did not betray the secret tool of the artist's trade by showing figures that were too stiff or an imbalance of finish between the high degree of attention paid to the immobile folds of the drapery and the relative sketchiness of the rest of the painting. Despite the equivocal feelings about their use among art theoreticians and peons of the artistic establishment, such as Ingres, who declared that, with a few exceptions, il faut bannir le mannequin, academic painters were often seen as the worst offenders when it came to over or misuse of the mannequin. Just two examples of this will suffice today. Paul de la Roche's execution of Lady Jane Grey, the star of the Salon of 1834 and continues to be a star in the National Gallery in London, is a painting that critics claimed reeked of the mannequin, sentait le mannequin, especially in the figure of the executioner. Ingres, who described the sight of Parisian spectators thronging in admiration around de la Roche's painting as a horrible vision, might well have agreed with the view that the too obviously based studio-based nature of Delaroche's famous painting was too apparent in this in his work, final work. But it was one of his own closest followers, Henri Lehmann, who in 1856 came in for the same criticism for his painting of the Oceanides, now in the museum at Gap, this time expressed in a wordless, mocking caricature in the Journal pour Rire. Those who adopted a strongly naturalistic stance, like the Pre-Raphaelites in England, for those, the stakes were especially high. To have hinted at using an artificial aid, such as the mannequin, would have compromised their most closely held precepts of painting directly and in detail from the natural world. So in these circumstances, the mannequin has yet another function, because not even the Pre-Raphaelites could do without it. And in Millet's case, the mannequin takes on the role of a sort of moral arbitrator, because it allowed him to recreate this intimate pose between soldier and lover. The lover is, in fact, Charles Dickens's daughter, Kate. Allowed them to recreate this intimate pose in a way that contemporary social mores would never have permitted. But in the first decades of the 19th century, we see yet another trend emerging, and in large measure as a response to the quest for ever more naturalistic mannequin. That is, that the mannequin was increasingly drawn out from behind the coulisses of the atelier and given a life of its own as a subject for the painting. At first, it was introduced in amusing and playful ways, part of a comic narrative unfolding in the canvas, such as those you see by two German artists of the Dusseldorf School, Heinrich von Rüstiger and Johann Peter Hasenclever. And this, in fact, this comic or anecdotal genre continued well into the 20th century and seems to have enjoyed especially long life in Britain. Later in the century, though, artists were more overt in making allusions to erotic studio encounters involving a mannequin, often, like in this painting by Boldini, making a play on the contrast between the living, nearly always female model and the inert mannequin that could nevertheless be manipulated to the male artist's will or desire. It's perhaps not without significance to mention that France also maintained for much of the 19th century a market edge on the provision of sex dolls, or dames de voyage, as they were referred to in an early 20th century sexology manual, who also referred to them as Parisian rubber articles. However, no artist in the 19th century evoked the relationship, if we can call it that, between artist and mannequin, man and his implement, more potently or provocatively than Edgar Degas in his astonishing portrait of his friend, the painter Henri-Michel Lévy. In it, the mannequin is clearly the painter's plaything, but it's no longer a game. Instead, Degas seems deliberately to play on the Hoffmanesque uncanny, suggesting by the artist's fox-like eyes and the crumpled body of the mannequin that lies at his feet that some act of violence has taken place. In this, Degas can be seen as prefiguring the more deliberately disturbing encounters between artist and mannequin explored by the surrealists over half a century later, nowhere more uncomfortably than in the dismembered and disarticulated dolls or poupées of Hans Bellmer. There's a lot more to say on this theme, and we plan to do so in the exhibition as well as in exploring the wider cultural context. Today's aim has been to show how the changes in the fabrication of the object, the relentless striving, especially in Paris, towards a more naturalistic mannequin, played a crucial role in extending the function of the mannequin in painterly practice, transforming it from a silent, if ubiquitous, studio tool into a viable subject for a painting with a powerful psychological voice of its own. Je vous remercie.